Now, to an Australian novelist who is something of a national treasure and the author of one of my favourite books of 2025 and one of your top 100 books of the 21st century, Geraldine Brooks, who published Memorial Days this year. It's a meditation on love and loss, much of it written on Flinders Island off the coast of Tasmania. She spends much of her time living in the United States on Martha's Vineyard off the coast of New England, but spends a big chunk of time here in Australia as well. We caught up for an end-of-year chat yesterday afternoon. Geraldine Brooks, welcome to Saturday Extra.
It's good to be here, Nick.
Geraldine, you spend your summers here. You regard Australia very much as your home. Is it good to be back?
It's wonderful to be back. I'm working on recentering my life here. It's just that I have these two incredibly inconvenient American children.
You're very much an Aussie, aren't you? I mean, that always strikes me about you.
Yeah, definitely.
You're not somebody who sort of left Australia to get away from Australia. Quite the opposite.
No, it was accident. You know, I married an American who turned out to be a more stubborn bastard than I was.
And you tried to get him to live here. And you did for a while, didn't you?
But I would get him back for a year here and a year there. And that was good because that meant my older son had half of his elementary schooling here. So he's got a real Aussie identity, which is great. And I'm working on that with my younger son. But it's not being helped by the fact that the Australian government doesn't recognise children adopted overseas as citizens by descent. So every time he comes, we have to re-up his permanent residency.
And
it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
And it's unfair.
And you've really campaigned to try and get that law changed.
I have. And it's frustrating that, you know, because it doesn't affect many people, but those of it affects a lot because adopted kids carry enough. They don't need this.
Yeah, right. You got a lot of love in 2025 from the listeners of ABC Radio National who voted for their top 100 books. You were one of the only two authors who got three. You're smiling away. You were obviously chuffed by that. You got three books in the top 100.
I was incredibly chuffed. And I thought it was the voters had great taste in putting Boy Swallow's Universe at the top because that is such a wonderful book. And I love sharing the honor of three with Anna Funder, who is one of my favorite writers. She's just brilliant. So yeah, no, it was, I was thrilled.
We met early in the year. We did a lovely book festival together, didn't we, in Sorrento on the Mornington Peninsula. It instantly became one of my favourite book festivals. You told me then you were working on a secret project, and I thought it would be something in the national security realm. You started out as a foreign correspondent. You are well connected in that area. But you were actually working on something else, and now you can tell us.
Yes, I helped Kamala Harris write her account of the presidential campaign, 107 days.
I'm so intrigued. How did that come about?
Well, I was just finishing off the very short book tour that I'd agreed to do for Memorial Days. Usually I'll go and talk as long as anybody wants to hear me, but for that book I set limits because it's such a personal story about losing my husband and the aftermath of that. And I thought I can't live in that headspace for too long. So I'd just done the last event in San Diego and the flight back to Sydney didn't leave till 10 o'clock that night. So I booked myself a spa day. And then I get a call from my agent saying they want to know if you'd be interested in helping Kamala Harris write her book. And I said, hell yes. And he said, well, we'll send a car and you can go and meet her today.
Oh.
So instead of getting a pedicure, I got to meet Kamala Harris and we found that we were incredibly aligned and she made the decision to go with me as her collaborator.
Why do you think she picked you in the first place?
I think that her editor who had acquired the project, Jonathan Karp, had said to her, you shouldn't go with a usual suspect, you should go with a storyteller.
And that was very striking about the book. I mean, here's what I normally do with books, Geraldine. I always read the acknowledgements first, right? Don't know why. I think it tells you a lot about the author and how generous they are.
I think you do it just to see if you're in them.
That very rarely happens. But this time I read the acknowledgements last. And going through this book, 107 days, I thought, wow, this is kind of novelistic. This is really elegantly written. I mean, part of me thought there was a kind of storytelling ability in this book that perhaps wasn't so evident in the storytelling of her campaign. And then I see your name.
Well, you know, one of the things I said to her at our first meeting was that when I'm writing my fiction, I'm often trying to recreate voices of the unheard, people who didn't get a chance to tell their own stories, like the enslaved who weren't allowed to learn to read and write in general, didn't get a chance to set down what it was like to be them. Women before the 18th century. Women still today in many countries. My very first book was about women in some Muslim countries who have very limited opportunities for education. And I said to her, this is a paradox because you've had access to every microphone in the world, but I still feel that you're unheard in some ways.
I mean, that's interesting. That was always the criticism of her during the campaign, wasn't it? That she wasn't really prepared to sort of fully pull back the curtains on her life, that she wasn't willing to reveal her interior self.
And her interior self is great. I mean, she's very funny. She's very salty. And she gives a shit. You know, she is really a dedicated public servant. And, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do this project was that it would give me somewhere to put my rage and disappointment about the results of the American election, which was just, you know, personally devastating, as well as devastating for the planet and its people. And at least for a few months, I was able to get up in the morning and feel like I was doing something.
You spoke about being aligned with her in that first meeting. Was that where you came together, that sense of frustration, that sense of annoyance, that sense of outrage?
Well, just we knew what he was going to do to the country. He'd already started. This was back in February. He'd started wrecking, you know, firing incredibly dedicated public servants working on enormous projects of great benefit, not only to Americans, but to the whole world. That was going on, but we didn't know about the performative cruelty that he was about to exact on immigrant populations in the United States and the just general disregard and disrespect for the people of this planet.
I was intrigued when you said that when you meet Kamala Harris in person, there's a warmth, there's a humor.
She's a very, very funny person, yeah.
People said exactly the same thing about Hillary Clinton. Do you think that female presidential candidates in particular, and there haven't been many, there's not many people to have a kind of sample of here, but do you think there is a tendency to sort of almost sort of shut themselves down during a campaign, to not reveal their full self?
I think if she had have had more time, she would have relaxed into it. Now that I've, you know, listened to basically every podcast she ever did, and she tended to be over-controlled in the big television interviews. And instead of that working for her, I think in a way it worked against her. But when you listen to her in more relaxed settings with lower stakes, she does reveal more of herself.
What was the process like?
So at first we met in person every day and she would talk and I would listen and then I would write something and give it to her and she'd go over it and amend it. And that was how we went on. And then once we'd built up a rhythm, I was able to come back here and I would get on Signal with her at 7 o'clock every morning, and that was...
Speaks of the secrecy of the project, right? You're on Signal.
Yeah.
And a friendship developed, she says, in the acknowledgements.
Yeah, I was very pleased that she saw it that way.
She speaks of your ferocious and brilliant artistic insights that were indispensable. You're laughing.
Well, I'm smiling. I'm gratified.
I mean, curiously, watching some of her interviews after the book came out, and there was a famous interview that she did with Sarah Ferguson on ABC 7:30.
I thought that was excellent. Sarah was...
I mean, Sarah was probing, wasn't
yes,
she?
Yes. And I think that is respectful, and it's doing a favor to the interviewee to ask hard questions and to not let them evade them. I think that helps people show what they're made of.
Kamala Harris had tough words in the book for Joe Biden and with Tim Walz, her running mate.
I don't think they were tough. What, did you think they were tough? I mean,
I thought she went maybe beyond what previous political memoirs would do. And what struck me about the interview with Sarah Ferguson was it was almost like she seemed to be distancing herself from those criticisms and from those comments.
Well, I think it's in the book, there's a lot of nuance. So if she criticizes an aspect of Biden, which is that, you know, he should have known better than to think he could run again at his advanced age. And she criticizes, I think, appropriately the hubris behind that. And she criticizes herself for not speaking up about it.
And the title itself, 107 Days, it speaks of the problem, right?
But, I mean, but just to finish the thought, in a short television interview, you can't get into that nuance. And I think she's got a lot of incredibly warm things to say about Biden as well. It was a complicated relationship. And I think to try and simplify it down into a soundbite is very hard. And I don't blame her for not wanting to put out there the harshest thing she had to say without everything else that goes with.
She's never expressed any regret about what was in the book.
Not as far as I've heard.
The publisher said the book was a different kind of political memoir. It's closer in spirit to The West Wing or Rocky. It reads like a suspense novel. Were you sort of determined to kind of make it quite novelistic?
Well, you know, I love The West Wing. And I have to admit that I did rewatch the entire thing, and there's a lot of it.
As preparation.
While I was writing the book, so to the extent that that was influential, yeah.
You're listening to ABC Radio National. It's Saturday Extra with me, Nick Bryant, and it's a great pleasure to have the author and journalist Geraldine Brooks on the show. Let's talk about Memorial Days, which came out this year. It was one of my favourite reads of the past 12 months. It's a rumination on grief. We've been talking about your husband, Tony Horwitz, who died on May the 27th, 2019, Memorial Day in the United States. I mean, to understand why this book is so special, I think it would help if you told us why Tony was so special.
Tony was obviously the love of my life, but he was a brilliant journalist and writer. He loved to figure out what made people tick, particularly people who thought differently to the way he thought. And he would run towards the people that most of us run away from. And in the United States, that was often exploring people who had very right-wing views. And I have to say, after he died and I was sitting with my son watching the people storming the Capitol, and there were Confederate flags, and there was all kinds of, you know, racist and right-wing rhetoric. And as I watched those people climbing over the barriers and breaking windows, I thought, holy cow, Tony's probably had a beer with at least 20% of them, because he really wanted to understand what made people think that way.
I mean, one of the things I did immediately after reading your book was to read his great book, Confederates in the Attic. It came out in the 1990s. You know, terribly, I didn't read it then. But it's a journey through the American South. It's a journey through the history of the American South, which very much animates the present. And as you say, I mean, Tony was interviewing Trump supporters before they realized they were Trump supporters.
Indeed, he was, and he kept doing it. And the book that he was on book tour for when he died so suddenly was called Spying on the South, and it was following the antebellum journey of Frederick Law Olmsted, who went on to be famous for creating Central Park and other incredibly iconic American landscapes. But before he found his métier, he was a reporter for the New York Times, and he'd been sent south right before the Civil War erupted to ask the question, why is our nation so divided and is there anything we can do about it? And Tony decided to redo that journey and ask the same question. And this was in the age of Trump, and he discovered that the divisions were fundamental, but they were no longer North-South particularly. They were urban and rural. They were educated versus people who hadn't had an opportunity to be educated. And I think one of the most wonderful parts of Spying on the South is a journey he takes on a coal barge with guys who can make good money doing that, you know, and this is this big mountain of dirty coal that moves through the rivers of Ohio. to the coal-fired plants that are warming the planet, but they have no choice. And it's a bit the same with, you know, the loggers of Tasmania. Bob Brown was telling me about a logger who came to his home and said, "You're blockading us. We thought we'd blockade you." And he said, "Well, come in and have a cup of tea then." And the man said to him in the course of that conversation, "You're taking away our jobs. I can't read and I can't write."
Well, it's fascinating you say that, isn't it? Because you spoke about a north-south divide becoming an urban-rural divide, but another divide now is an educational divide.
Very much so, yeah.
And one of the criticisms of MAGA World is that elites sneer at Trump's supporters. I mean, what struck me about Tony's writing was there was no sneering. It was
absolutely no sneering.
There was empathy.
And, you know, appreciation for people in their full dimensions. So he talks to people who have opinions that he might find deplorable, but he doesn't find them deplorable. There are no deplorables in Tony's world, and he could have a laugh and share a beer and find a way to connect with people, and we need to do more of that. And I would also say it's a bit of a mischaracterization of MAGA, because there's plenty of highly educated elites, including, you know, J.D. Vance, expensively educated Ivy League universities. So it's not just that.
We deal in caricatures, don't we? But that's the great thing about Tony's work. I mean, he doesn't deal in caricatures.
No.
His death was such a shock. He died of a heart attack while he was on a book tour in Washington, D.C. The way you learnt about it is the starting point for the book, and it was almost industrial. It was almost sort of heartless the way that you found out.
It was pretty brutal, and I have to say popular culture does not prepare you for this, because in movies and books, somebody always comes to the door, don't they? And they make sure you're sitting down and they give you a glass of water and ask who they can call. Well, none of that happened. I picked up the phone to a very tired resident at the end of her long shift. And honestly, she couldn't get me off the phone fast enough. She said, "You know, he collapsed in the street, and I'm expecting to hear that, and now we're treating him for whatever." And she says, "We couldn't revive him and he's dead." And it was just like that. And I was all alone. And I think, you know, in retrospect, it's pretty dangerous to do that.
To recover from that trauma, you headed to Australia.
Well, not straight away.
Not straight away, but
no, I had a million.
Eventually.
I had a. The trouble with modern death is you don't, you cannot afford to do what you need to do, which is throw a black veil over your head and go and sit under a yew tree, and absorb the enormous thing that's just happened to you. Modern life doesn't allow for that. Had I done that, I mean, I think I say in the book, it's a bit like you're juggling flaming brands and you have to keep them moving in the air, because if you drop one, you know, your whole life will go up in flames. And that, I was just catching falling things for ages. And then I kind of felt like I felt this obligation to pretend that I was okay. And so I did this act of woman being normal for quite a long time, and I wasn't right in the head. And finally, it was 3 years since Tony had died, and I was still not myself. I was pretending to be something I wasn't, and that was when I came running back to the most isolated and lovely part of Australia I could think of, and rented a shack on the beach and did the work that I hadn't been allowed to do when he died.
You speak in the book about finally feeling an unfurling, an unclenching of the soul.
Yeah, you know, I think I arrived on Flinders Island in the Bass Strait carrying a whole bunch of bags of crap, basically. And one by one, I was able to unpack and take all that out. And the biggest thing I realized was I had to give up on mourning the life that I expected to have of growing old with Tony and sharing the same jokes. And we'd always laughed about, you know, sitting in our rocking chairs and never missing a sunset, making sure we had a porch that faced west. And it was on Flinders Island that I realized that life's gone and you'll never get that life. So stop. Stop thinking about it. Grab the life that you have got and live it as best you can.
As part of that catharsis, how important was country?
Nature's very important to me. And, you know, I grew up in Burwood, which is not exactly the bush. And we had
a suburb of Sydney.
Yeah, in a suburb, and we had a small backyard. But my mother was very good at teaching me to ferociously notice things. So we would do the tour of that backyard, and not one insect escaped our scrutiny. But I'd never camped or been in wilderness until I became a newspaper reporter. And I went to work for the Sydney Morning Herald. And the environment roundsman was very good, but he was also not young. So when a story involved something like rafting down the Franklin River or doing a backcountry ski camping trip to look at an area under threat, he wasn't really up to that. And I wasn't up to it either, but I did it anyway, and it was fantastic and life-changing. And I've found wilderness particularly sustaining ever since. And where I was on Flinders isn't exactly wilderness, but it was pretty out there. So I was staying in a shack in it. It looks like it might be a town. There's a dot on the map and it says Leeka, but there was nothing there. And when I looked it up in the census, do you know what the population of Leeka is?
What is it?
Nil.
It was one.
One then.
How long were you there for?
Just a few weeks, but that time was just devoted to being with the memory of Tony and working through the stuff that I didn't get to work through in the immediate aftermath of losing him.
How are you traveling now?
I think pretty good. The boys and I think, have both decided to embrace radical gratitude for what we had.
Geraldine, this is the last live show of the year. And we did this thing on the program called The Last Thing. We asked people for their last great books or their last great TV series. Have you read any great books recently?
So I've read two books that have been incredibly inspiring to me. Usually I read a lot of fiction, but these are two non-fiction books and they're a beautiful companion piece to each other. Because I get a lot of despair about where we're at with the climate, particularly with Donald Trump and data centers sucking up so much power right when we need to be cutting back. And you feel like, oh my God, we're just walking into this catastrophe. And these two books accept what's at stake, but they also show a way out. And one is Defiance by Bob Brown, which is a just fantastically affirming book because it reminds you that brave people can change things. And it goes back over his life as a defiant activist and all the times he's been thrown in the slammer. But the things that we have because of that work, including the Franklin River, which I think everybody in this country would say, we're glad that we saved that river instead of giving it up for a nugatory amount of power. And also the work he's doing right now in the Tark Iron with a lot of young activists who are just putting their bodies in the way of destroying old growth forest that is home to endangered species and trees of the like that Europe wishes it still had. You know, it's a magnificent place. And they've managed to slow the destruction there, and hopefully they can bring the federal government to the decision that needs to be made to make this World Heritage. And I think we'll all be so grateful for that. But anyway, Defiance is a book about what action can accomplish, and it's kind of a call to do what we can. Whatever you can do in your small patch is worth doing. And then the other book is by Bill McKibben, who's kind of the prophet of climate change. He wrote a book in 1989 called The End of Nature, which basically predicted everything that has happened. And if we had acted then, which we were perfectly capable of doing. We wouldn't be in the predicament we are now. But his new book is called Here Comes the Sun. And it's basically refuting that there's no way that we can have a prosperous society without coal and oil and gas. And he just goes through it bit by bit in a very engaging text. He's a wonderful writer.
That's Defiance by Bob Brown and Here Comes
the Sun. And he talks about how we have all we need to have a clean energy transition with solar power. And it's incredibly persuasive.
A movie?
So the movie was called All That Is Left of Me. And it's by an American-Palestinian filmmaker. It's a family history of one Palestinian family, actually. And it starts with a scene that was achingly familiar to me because I started out as a Middle East correspondent in 1987 with the first Intifada. And I was very green and I didn't know what I was doing. And I'd often find myself in these very chaotic confrontations between young Palestinian stone throwers and young Israeli conscripts. And that's exactly where this movie starts, with a young boy getting caught up in one of these demonstrations. And spoiler alert here, because if you don't want to know what happens in this movie, hum loudly for a minute, but this boy gets shot. And the movie revolves around his parents' decisions about whether to donate his organs, knowing that they may well go to Israelis. And it's entirely the history told from a Palestinian point of view. And at first, as a Jewish person, I thought, you know, all the Israelis in this movie are so awful. But I think it's really good for us to enter that perspective and really feel it. And she, the director who also acts in the movie, Shireen Davis, is a wonderful storyteller, and it's a very character-driven movie. And I think what we need on both sides of that issue is empathy for the other. And this movie is a really good start on that.
And presumably, it reminds you of your days as a foreign correspondent.
Well, very much so. And I think the fact that, you know, she kind of had me because she captured the vibe of that 1987 moment so perfectly that I was inclined to trust her a lot as a filmmaker for the, you know, and she was barely alive at that time, so she managed to obviously do the work.
A belly laugh.
Belly laugh. Okay, so when Jimmy Kimmel briefly got the axe after some fairly innocuous remarks.
It was about Charlie Kirk, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yeah. About Charlie Kirk.
The MAGA provocateur, the MAGA influencer who
was assassinated.
Who was assassinated.
Yeah. Jon Stewart did a show that was the Trump-compliant Daily Show. And it just made me laugh so hard because every detail of it was so perfect, starting with, you know, instead of the usual introduction, it had all these patriotic images, and then the set had all been tricked out in gold leaf, and he was wearing a long red tie and telling his audience not to laugh inappropriately because this was the new Trump-compliant Daily Show. And it was just a beautiful piece of satire.
Geraldine Brooks, it has been such a treat to talk to you on Saturday Extra. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Nick.
That was the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks speaking about her latest book, Memorial Days, and about working with Kamala Harris to help write 107 Days, the account of Kamala Harris's short presidential campaign.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.